Hello and welcome to this bumper edition of the 2023 winter and Christmas edition of the Sidvale and East Devon Talking magazine, being read at the Dissenters Hall, Sidmouth, on Thursday the 30th of November, with editors and readers Hayden
and Paul, and readers Gillian, Gerald and Anne-Marie, and our producer Sam Clark. Should you have any problems with equipment, please contact Wendy Eagles on 07552 766 382.
Part one starts with Paul telling us about smuggling in Devon. Gillian reads Bees of Yonder Oakwood, and Gerald asks, what's in a name?
And Hayden tells us the sad story of Jack Leslie, a famous Plymouth Argyle player from the 1920s. And Marie discovers some interesting things about Japan. And Paul brings part one to a close with do-it-yourself nourishing delights. Smuggling in Devon. There have been several books and articles written about smuggling in the West Country, naming one or two famous smugglers, including Jack Rattenbury from Beer. It was a constant fight by the authorities to catch the many men and women involved in bringing in contraband. When the offenders were caught, they were taken before the Justices of the Peace at the Devon Quarter Sessions. There are countless records of these offences in the early 19th century, which name the culprits, what they were smuggling, and where they were caught. The punishment meted out was different for seafaring men and for those who organised or stored the contraband. Seamen were condemned to spend 5 years in the Royal Navy, and the other offenders were fined £100, which is approximately £4,500 in modern money, with a lengthy time spent in jail until the money was paid. It's easy to see how difficult it was for the excise officers to contain the large amount of smuggling that was going on in East and South Devon when one sees the number of small coves along the coast. So where were these men captured? The course records the name and capture of the boats in the Bristol Channel, used to describe the sea off the Devon coast, or the British Channel. Men and women were also convicted of storing contraband or moving it across the land. In 1825, a woman from Branscombe, the wife of a labourer, was fined £100 for having a gallon of smuggled foreign brandy, which was seized from her at Salcombe Regis. The punishment was the same for smuggling large amounts of contraband at sea or for storing small amounts on land. In both cases, the goods were seized. Men were also prosecuted for lighting a bonfire in Beer as a signal to smugglers. What were these men smuggling? All cases recorded name, the goods as brandy and Geneva, which was a type of gin. The excise duty on these drinks brought over from the continent was an important tax for the government, and for the smugglers, a secret source of income. In 1796, an annual license to sell beer and other drinks, except brandy, rum and Geneva, cost £1.17.6. A further charge of £2.04 was made for a license to sell foreign wine. And to sell distilled liquors, the license cost £6.06. A sloop in the Bristol Channel off the coast of Dorset was captured, carrying 387 gallons of brandy and 312 gallons of Geneva. Six men were caught off the Exmouth coast, smuggling 90 gallons of brandy and 60 gallons of Geneva. Four seamen were sentenced to serve in the Royal Navy for carrying 100 gallons each of brandy and Geneva. John Rattenbury's boat was caught carrying 70 gallons of brandy and 69 gallons of Geneva off the Devon coast. Rattenbury was fined £100. In 1827, a boat was found to contain 335 gallons of brandy and 82 gallons of Geneva, which was 152 casks. The perpetrators were three seamen condemned to serve in the Royal Navy and two Frenchmen who were fined £100 each. Zut alors. According to the size of the ship and the numbers involved, the hoard of contraband ranged from small quantities on a small boat to the larger amounts listed above. A man from East Budley was fined for harbouring 3 pints of brandy, and another from the same parish for holding 2 quarts of brandy and 7 pints of Geneva. Possibly, these men were innkeepers of the parish or were selling the drink on to the licensed trade. At the same time, another man from Budley Salterton was fined for having in his possession 3.5 pints of brandy and 5.5 pints of Geneva. All the men were fined £100. Some of those convicted were caught carrying their contraband to another parish. A Sidbury man was convicted for taking 1 4-gallon cask of brandy and Geneva to Otterton, and a man from Limston was convicted of carrying away 3 gallons of brandy and 3 of Geneva. This was not the only type of smuggling done at this time. In 1817, an account was given in the Exeter Flying Post of a person residing in Guernsey who had made several trips across the Channel in a vessel from that island and always carried his bedstead ashore on his arrival, until suspicion was aroused that this piece of furniture was not a mere sleeping partner, but was stuffed with lace, stockings and shawls, etc., to the value of £300.
This is Gillian with Bees at Yonder Oak Wood. At Yonder Oak Wood, there has been another exciting development. The Woodland Trust is carefully monitoring and encouraging the current flora and fauna in what will become the new wood. It will soon be a refuge for plants, insects, and other wildlife that is under pressure. So, as well as hoping to provide a safe area for bumblebees, the Trust has provided potential homes for wild honeybees. On the last day of July this year, the artificial nests were erected at Yonder Oak. The beekeeper responsible came down from Hampshire with the 3 hives in the back of his pickup, along with ladders and a host of ropes and pulleys. Each nest consists of a length of softwood tree trunk, bored out to seem like a hollow tree. The point being that in the countryside, there are fewer and fewer mature trees that can offer bees their natural home. Each log is about 1.3 metres long, with the centres bored out to approximately 25 centimetres and with 3 entrance holes bored through to the nest cavity. Together with other volunteers helping, we rub the inside of the logs with propolis to encourage scout bees to venture inside. We also pinned 3 pieces of old honeycomb to the lid to encourage comb building from the top down, which is what the bees would naturally do. The old black comb was in a plastic box. Some of the cells still contained a little honey, honey being the only natural food that never goes off. After about 10 minutes, a bee found the box. In another 15 minutes, 6 bees were flying around the box. And after another 15 minutes, there were probably 150 bees making quite a noise. So the first bees had flown back to their home and told their sisters, through the waggle dance, where this food source lay. It's easy to forget, these amazing creatures have a brain. All the bees coming in and departing were on the same line of flight. The lid was fixed and covered with a wad of fiberglass and covered with a heavy plastic liner that we nailed on to retain warmth in the nest over winter. Then these heavy logs were winched up to the chosen trees after any small branches had been trimmed away to allow a snug fit to the bee trunk. Once in the correct position, the next logs were secured with nylon tie-down traps, tensions on a ratchet. The organisation and the development of each individual bee within the colony is fascinating. The queen is in charge. Her pheromones give the colony its identity and also inhabit the development of the worker bees, which are also female. She mates in flight with a number of male drones, storing their sperm in her abdomen. At the height of the laying season, she may be laying 2 eggs a minute, the vast majority of which are fertilised and therefore female. However, if she reverses into a larger cell, she will not fertilise the egg and it will become a haploid male with half the chromosomes of a female. As she ages and her pheromone levels drop, the workers begin building drone cells, and as the number of males rises, they build queen cells as well to trigger swarming. The workers take an egg from a worker cell and place it in the extra-large queen cell with a lot of royal jelly secreted from glands in the heads of young bees. This transforms the worker egg into a much larger young queen. She does the intelligent thing and scarpers before the old queen can get hold of her, taking a lot of the workers with her as a swarm. The scouts who have been looking for a suitable home could potentially lead her to yonder oak wood's waiting hives and into the 5-star accommodation provided, but not until next May. Listening to the beekeeper, who has put up many such hives all over the West Country and on into Wales, rekindled my interest in bees. Naturally, you will know our fruit, flowers and vegetables depend on bees, the major pollinators, and yet we continue to produce and spray bee-killing chemicals, destroying 150 million years of evolutionary perfection without a second thought.
Hello, this is Gerald, and I'm reading What's in a Name. Baptismal names of children before the 20th century were usually chosen to follow a family tradition. Some of the names were chosen as those of the British monarch, as well as of saints, apostles, or biblical characters. Amongst the latter, Elizabeth, Anne, and Mary had always been popular, being the names of the Virgin and of her mother Anne, and Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist. It was usual for the oldest son to be named after his father, and other sons after their grandfathers, with the same pattern applying to daughters. Another tradition was to add the maiden name of the mother to the children's names. This applied to all christenings, from the aristocracy down to the poorest labourers. Many of the names chosen in the earlier periods had a distinct Old Testament flavour, such as Abraham, Amos, Aaron, Charity, Elias, Ezekiel, Israel, Joel, Moses, Pasha, Sidwell, Temperance, and Zacharias. These names would have been the most commonly heard in a Bible reading society, when other books were not known to the parishioners. Other unusual early names in Woodbury included Anastasia, Letitia, Lucretia, Pascalia, and Wilmot. All the above names appear in the Woodbury Baptismal Register. Another tradition was in the naming of twins. In scouring the Woodbury Parish Registers, several sets of twins are identified, not just from the dates of the baptism. Often families would have more than one child baptised on the same day, but by the names chosen. Some examples of the names chosen were often John and James, or Jacob and Esau, and other pairings from the Bible, female twins, were frequently called Mary and Martha, or Leah and Rachel, and mixed-sex twins were Joseph and Mary, or William and Mary. Middle names were not usually used, except when adding the mother's family name, until the 19th century. This did not apply to the ruling classes, as the inclusion of a variety of names was an identity to their genealogical trees. Sometimes a child was named because of an event that had affected the parents. If a baptized child died, its name was given to a later child born to the parents. This naming of another child has caused much confusion for people tracing their families. In 1755, a boy was born to John and Mary Webber in Zeal Monachorum. They had already produced a son and daughter called John and Mary a few years before. They must have had a religious moment as they decided to call this new son Mahershalal Hasbaz. I wonder whether they could spell it and what they shortened it to. The boy's second cousin, also born in Zeal Monachorum, had a name called Ezekiel, who moved to Cliff St George and later Ebford, where he raised a large family. Mahershalal Hasbaz was evidently not impressed with his name, as he called his own children John and Mary. One of the problems genealogists have faced has been the fact that until the inclusion of middle names in the title of a baby, it was very difficult to identify the actual person one was searching for, especially with the tradition of passing down the parents' and grandparents' names to their offspring. In a secular society, the term forename is now used in place of Christian name. This makes sense since so many of the names that babies are now called are anything but Christian. Surnames are derived from a very different source. Some are descriptions of occupations, such as baker, miller, smith, tucker, etc. Others are taken from descriptions of the natural environment, as, for example, brook, hill, lane, etc., and others from the names of settlements where people lived. Some names changed from the simple John at the Well to John Atwell, Stephen Bythemead to Stephen Bidmead, Bythcombe to Biddicombe. There are several more examples to be found in the Woodbury Parish registers and early documents in the 14th and 15th centuries. The spellings of many early surnames have been simplified over the years, and many have been adapted to sound more English. The names of the French Huguenots who settled in England in the 16th century and other immigrants to Britain. A document held in Exeter Cathedral Library archives, dated in the 11th century, lists two guilds of Woodbury men and women who paid money annually to the Benedictine Monastery of St. Peter's in Exeter, later Exeter Cathedral, and whose names are all pre-Norman. The next document to record the names of Woodbury men is dated 1332, when not a single name of the 45 men listed bears any resemblance to the earlier ones. Just from a few examples, it is easy to see how our present-day surnames originated and have changed over the years.
Joan, that was great, that reading, and tricky, as some of those names were incredibly tricky, weren't they?
They were extremely tricky, yes.
And this bit about Hasblatt, was it?
Oh, gosh. Yes, I mean, it's they spell it M-A-H-E-R, Shalal, S-H-A-L-A-L, Has, H-A-S, and then B-A-Z, Hasbaz.
Well done for doing that one. This article, by the way, is from the Woodbury News, and it was written by a local historian called Jill Selly. We get quite a few articles from her work, which is great. She's well known in Woodbury in the district, but I think you did a really good interpretation of that, so thanks for that.
Thanks very much.
Hello, this is Hayden. This is about The Lion Who Never Roared, from a book recently published by Matt Tiller, the story of Jack Leslie of Plymouth Argyle, published by Pitch Publishing. I am a lifelong Bristol City fan, but my wife supported Plymouth Argyle, attending matches at Home Park from a young girl with a much-loved uncle. It was this that aroused my interest in the story of Jack Leslie, who played for Argyle in the 1920s. And the campaign to erect a statue in his honour. More recently, Matt Tiller's book, The Lion Who Never Roared, was published, that movingly tells his story. Jack Leslie was raised in East London and was talent spotted by a number of league clubs who competed for his signature. His goal-scoring exploits eventually aroused the interest of Plymouth Argyle, to where he was transferred and for many seasons became a hero to his adoring fans. One morning in 1923, his excited manager, Bob Jack, called him into his office to tell him he had been selected to play for England in the forthcoming match against Ireland. The news was all over the local and national newspapers, and Jack couldn't easily walk the streets of Plymouth for all the backslapping from Argyle fans. When the final team sheet was published before the international match, Jack Leslie's name was absent and had been replaced by an Arsenal player. What the FA selection committee didn't know prior to his selection was that Jack Leslie was black. The FA cancelled his selection and he was never chosen to play for England again. This was the same all-white and male FA membership that banned women and girls from playing football, which lasted for the next 50 years. Jack Leslie's story is told in Matt Tiller's biography, which has a foreword by Viv Anderson, who finally became officially the first black player to be chosen to play for England in 1978, 55 years after Jack Leslie's abortive selection. In the past year, Jack Leslie's statue has been secured in Pride of Place at Home Park. His granddaughters were presented with Jack's posthumous England cap by Viv Anderson before an England international against Ukraine in March 2023. Since then, the Leslie family has donated it to Plymouth Argyle to be displayed in its boardroom. In the foreword to The Lion Who Never Roared, Viv Anderson makes the following observations. The first time I heard the name Jack Leslie was when a BBC journalist contacted me in 2020. And I was shocked, but was I surprised? Sadly not. Many of the stories of those black footballers who came before me are yet to be told, and I was more than happy to support the campaign to honour Jack with a statue. I had already been involved in the Arthur Wharton Foundation celebrating the remarkable first black professional who died in 1930 while Jack was still playing. What happened to Jack Leslie is a crying shame, but he broke the mould in his time, just as people say I did in 1978. I didn't realise it at the time, but taxi drivers still tell me they remember my debut. So I imagine it would have been similar for Jack. The significance of what he achieved and the impact of the injustice that happened to him probably came later in life. It's incredible to read Jack's story now and how his selection to play for his country was swept away. I think he was the same ilk as me in wanting to dismiss whatever abuse he got and get on with forging a career. To achieve what he did for Plymouth Argyle and become a local hero, he must have been some player. Jack would have been getting all kinds of stick just like I did. So I can relate to what he went through. But I was lucky to have the likes of Laurie Cunningham and Cyril Regis around me, whereas Jack was on his own. Having Brian Clough as a manager helped me. And I remember walking out to an away ground once and saying to him, "I don't think I can play today." Mr. Clough's reply stuck with me. "You are here because you've got ability. It wouldn't be otherwise. You are playing." I got through those tough times, and I hope Jack had the same kind of support. He certainly went out and gave it his all, just as I did. Jack's life story is inspiring and important. It's part of our history and culture. I consider my parents, Myrtle and Audley, as heroes and pioneers of the Windrush generation. Jack was the son of an immigrant who journeyed here too, and his experience offered the same kind of insight into an earlier period. What they went through to help future generations, it's worth reflecting on and sharing.
This is Anne Marie discovering Japan. Steeped in ancient tradition, with everything from temples and tranquil countryside to thriving cosmopolitan cities, Japan represents a harmonious balance between old and new. Japan's popularity with holidaymakers has skyrocketed over the last decade. This is a country that has it all. So whether you're looking to get lost in the dazzling lights of Tokyo or while away your days beneath the cherry blossoms, here's a breakdown of what not to miss. Experience the energy of Tokyo. Tokyo is a city that never sleeps. Often coined the Times Square of Japan, Shibuya is the beating heart of this metropolis. Lose yourself amongst the district's towering skyscrapers and walk across the famous Shibuya Crossing, a mesmerizing spectacle of humanity in motion. For a taste of tradition, visit the city's Meizi Zingu, a tranquil Shinto shrine nestled within 70 hectares of sprawling forest, or explore the historic Asakusa district, home to the Sensoji Temple and bustling Nakamise shopping district. Explore the ancient city of Kyoto. Having served as the country's imperial capital for over 1,000 years, a visit to Japan wouldn't be complete without exploring the historic city of Kyoto. You'll feel like you've stepped back in time as you wander through the city's treasure trove of temples, shrines, and gardens. The Kinkakuzi Temple, also known as the Golden Pavilion, is not to be missed. Adorned with gold leaf, this ethereal Zen Buddhist temple is surrounded by manicured gardens designed for practicing deep meditation. Soak up the beauty of Japan's cherry blossoms. Cherry blossoms, or sakura, hold a special place in Japanese culture, ushering in the arrival of spring and the beginning of the farming season. So much so that many Japanese even hold parties to celebrate hanami, the practice of watching the blossoms and contemplating life. Fortunately, there are lots of viewing spots around the country from late January all the way through to early May. Some of the most renowned are Ueno Park in Tokyo, Maruyama Park in Kyoto, or Hirosaki Castle Park in Aomori Prefecture. Visit Mount Fuji. At 3,776 meters tall, Mount Fuji, also known as Fuji-san, is the tallest peak in Japan, and perhaps its most sacred. Having long been a site of spiritual importance and source of artistic inspiration, it remains an active volcano to this date, with its last eruption dating back to 1707. Visit Japan during the climbing season, July to September, to hike to the summit, or for a more leisurely approach, visit one of the five lakes at the foot of the mountain, where you can capture the reflection of Mount Fuji on the water. Pay your respect at Hiroshima. While it carries a somber history on its shoulders as the site of the World War II atomic bombing, Hiroshima has risen from the ashes to become a symbol of resilience and hope. Visit this now thriving city to pay your respects at the Peace Memorial Park and Museum, which is dedicated to promoting peace and honoring the city's victims, while offering a glimpse of the indomitable spirit of the Japanese people.
Well, thanks, Anne-Marie. That was great. That was really nicely read. And some of those were really challenging each other today with those names of towns and things. Just one interesting fact I just thought I'd throw in. Kyoto and Tokyo are two, you know, obviously major cities in Japan. And what each of them are an anagram of the other. Mm-hmm. Are we impressed?
We are, yes.
Thank you very much. Hello, this is Paul here with an article entitled Do-It-Yourself Nourishing Delights. That should exercise the imagination. Anyway, these homemade health and beauty products are quick, easy and effective and are made from ingredients likely already in your kitchen. So the first one is how to make a face mask. This face mask is a gentle exfoliator and very moisturizing. It doesn't keep, so use it as soon as you've made it. You'll need some honey, a ripe avocado, some olive oil, and some finely ground almonds. And that's, they're optional, the almonds. You mash a quarter of an avocado and mix it with 1 tablespoon of honey, 1 tablespoon of olive oil, and 2 tablespoons of finely ground almonds. Smooth it onto your face and relax for 20 minutes before washing it off. But be warned, it's very messy. The next one is something I've never heard of before. It's called a hair mask. So a hair mask works to deeply condition your hair to provide essential moisture and to tame frizz. For this you will need, it's unlikely, but you will need a banana, an avocado and some olive oil. So you mash the banana with half an avocado until there are no lumps. You mix in 2 tablespoons of olive oil. Work the mask through your hair, avoiding the roots. Cover with a shower cap. Wash out within 30 minutes before the hair mask starts to dry. This is ideal for using up an overripe banana that's languishing in the fruit bowl. How about body oil? This is body oil next. Hayden, you might be interested in this. This do-it-yourself body oil should stay fresh for at least 6 months, so you could make a few batches to give as Christmas gifts too. You'll need a carrier oil, an aromatherapy or essential oil, and some vitamin E oil. A carrier oil, by the way, moisturizes your skin and carries any extra ingredients, such as aromatherapy oils. Sweet almond oil is an excellent choice for your carrier oil, as it is rich in antioxidants, very hydrating and easy for your skin to absorb. You can always use jojoba, avocado, sesame seed, and even extra virgin olive oil. For the aromatherapy oil, the main thing is to choose a scent you like. So lavender, calendula, and jasmine are good for dry, itchy, or skin, while lemon, patchouli, and bergamot can help balance oily skin. Vitamin E oil is optional, but it's an excellent antioxidant and will help your homemade body oil stay fresh for longer. To make this work, you mix 50 milliliters of your chosen carrier oil with up to 1 milliliter, 16 to 20 drops of aromatherapy oil, and 1/4 milliliter, 4 to 5 drops of vitamin E oil. Pour it into a clean, dry bottle and keep away from direct sunlight. Ideally, use a coloured glass bottle, which will help to protect the oil from light. Finally, body scrub. Body scrubs are fantastic exfoliates used to remove dead skin cells for soft, supple skin. You will need some olive oil, some brown sugar, and aromatherapy or essential oil. Slowly pour up to 50 milliliters of olive oil into 100 milliliters of sugar. Mix as you pour until you get the consistency you're looking for. You might not need the whole 50 mil. Mix in up to 20 drops of aromatherapy oil. Again, choose a fragrance you like. Citrus scents work well for a body scrub, or go for something warming and comforting like sandalwood. If you decant the scrub into an airtight mason jar, it should last for a few weeks. But please note that you should never use undiluted essential oils on your skin, as they can cause irritation. Some essential oils aren't suitable for use during pregnancy, so do make sure you check the bottle.
And we're still with Paul, who has some news from Devon Insight.
Thank you, Hayden. All right, news from Devon Insight. Well, Devon Insight offers a range of holistic services for anyone affected by sight loss across Devon. They can provide support to people who are blind or partially sighted, and to family members, friends and carers. Devon Insight aim to provide impartial information, advice and guidance service to better equip you with the information you need. The Independent Living Service works with you to identify the equipment, support and training that will help you to maintain your independence and live life to the full. And a health and well-being service that includes emotional support and formal counselling. You can access any of the services by calling the helpline on 01392 876 666.
And now for part two. Gillian reads a vicar's letter, followed by the secret life of Pembrokeshire puffins, related by Gerald.
And Hayden reads from Sam Lee's award-winning The Nightingale, and this delightful bird's importance in folk music. Gerald continues her fascination with small mammals and relates a year in the life of the hedgehog.
And Anne-Marie offers some wintry musings from the pillow book of Seyi Shonagon. Paul concludes this edition by telling us about other people's Christmases.
This is a letter from the Vicar of St. James the Least of All to his nephew Darren, the incumbent of a very modern church, on two wise men, one three-legged sheep, and a tipsy tree. My dear nephew Darren, it really is time to get some new figures for the crib. After a series of accidents over the years, we are now down to two wise men, two shepherds, and one three-legged sheep that only remains upright if it is leaning against a shepherd. Joseph, having been obliged to stand outside the shelter of the stable for the last four decades, is now comprehensively veneered with bat droppings. In a rather desperate effort to enlarge this frugal cast, Miss Timmins hit on the idea of introducing characters from the children's Easter garden. This would have all been very well if both sets of figures had been to the same scale. But we now have the shepherds apparently being threatened by two 10-foot rabbits. One of our local farmers, I am sure very kindly meant, donated far more straw for the stable than was necessary. Our decorators, refusing to let his generosity go to waste, used the lot. The result is that Mary and Joseph stand up to their waists, looking as if they are being engulfed by a straw snowdrift. The crib, along with baby Jesus, has disappeared completely. The latter is not entirely to be regretted, since that no one can now see that Jesus has no nose and only one arm, result of one of our children dropping him on the floor at last year's crib service. I am sure that your ecologically appropriate Christmas tree, made of recycled dustbin liners, will be much appreciated by your congregation, knowing that they are saving the planet for future generations. We, however, remain traditional, with a tree always donated by the local squire from his estate, even if it is at the cost of adding another degree to global warming. Not only does it look more fitting, but it gives our verger something to do on Twelfth Night, sweeping up several hundredweight of pine needles. I sometimes wonder if it is an entire coincidence that the tree is always delivered by the estate staff on a day when there has been torrential rain in the area. Carrying it into church up the aisle makes it look as if the parting of the Red Sea has unsuccessfully taken place inside St. James. The major problem every year is getting the wretched thing to stand upright in the sanctuary. It takes so long that I sometimes feel it would be quicker to realign all the church pillars to the same angle as the tree itself. Last year's decision to have tree lights, which flashed in succession, was not a success. Those members who stared at them for too long while singing carols tended to fall over, although I suspect that Major Crump's inability to remain upright at the midnight service was for rather different reasons. Not using flashlights this year, the Major will have to find a different excuse. Enjoy your Christmas in a modern way. We will stick with tradition. Your loving uncle, Eustace.
That's brilliant.
This is Gerald with The Secret Life of Pembrokeshire's Puffins. When a ship was wrecked off the estuary that joins Pembrokeshire with Ceredigion in the 1800s, the record of the incident described the quirky feathered inhabitants of the small island where the wreck occurred as Pembrokeshire penguins. A class clown among seabirds, these comical little creatures are one of the UK's favourite birds. But what do we really know about the life of Pembrokeshire's puffins? They take their time to move in. Puffins live at sea during the winter,
Pembrokeshire's puffins are partial to the North Sea due to its large fish population. When they do move back to their breeding colony at Skomer Island in North Pembrokeshire, they take their time to readjust to land and can take weeks to fully settle into their island burrows. Puffins live underground, which isn't as cosy as it sounds. Only a few birds worldwide, including kingfishers and some types of penguins, live in burrows. On Skomer, Pembrokeshire's main breeding site, our puffins are in constant battle with the island's other frequent visitor, the Manx shearwater. They also use similar burrows for nesting, and the competition to claim burrows can be fierce. For this reason, puffins like to nest close to the cliff tops to give them a better chance of entering burrows quickly and evading those pesky seabirds. Female puffins lay a single egg. Puffin eggs are no bigger than a hen's egg and is incubated for around 6 weeks by both parents in their underground nest. Their chicks live in the burrow for around 6 weeks before venturing outside, relying on its parents to bring it sand eels to fatten it up in readiness for its open-air adventures. Puffins are mostly nocturnal. Due to their smaller stature, with fledgling chicks weighing no more than about 300 grams, our Pembrokeshire puffins are targets for larger predators, such as larger gulls, which will attack even adult birds. For this reason, they tend to come out at night, make their way down the cliffs of Skomer, and take off under the cover of darkness. Their little wings aren't a genetic disadvantage. These little creatures look quite comical when flying through the air, and due to their very small wingspan, have to flap their wings twice as fast to get anywhere. However, the actual use is for swimming underwater, and the smaller wings become extremely aerodynamic paddles used to push themselves through the water in search for fish. A puffin's beak isn't always red. Puffins are known for their brightly coloured beaks, but they only show it off during the breeding season. In winter, the scutes on their beaks molt, revealing a muted, small black beak. The oldest puffin recorded in Pembrokeshire is 38 years old. The average age nationwide is 25 years, but we think that the Pembrokeshire air definitely has its advantage for these little birds. Your best chance of seeing a puffin in Pembrokeshire is during the summer months. They tend to return to their burrows in April until the colonies become deserted again in early August. But your best chance of seeing the puffins is from mid-June to mid-July, when the parents are actively popping back and forth with up to 10 fish a day for their newly hatched chicks. Visitor numbers on Skomer are limited to 250 people per day, so as not to overcrowd the area and scare off the approximately 22,500 colourful characters. Boat trips to Skomer leave from St. Justinian's a few times a day during the summer months.
Hello, this is Hayden again. This extract is taken from The Nightingale, a book by Sam Lee, who is a Mercury Prize-nominated folk singer, conservationist and curator. Before becoming a musician, he trained as a wilderness survival expert. He is a folk music specialist dedicated to collecting, restoring and sharing ancient music from Britain and Ireland. When it comes to folk song, the nightingale tends to reveal more about the culture that is singing about him or her than about the actual nature of the bird. In the United Kingdom, nightingales are given a variety of guises that reveal the diversity of ways in which the British project the national character onto nature. These depictions range from bite-sized comical creature to the witness of heart sorrow, as is more common in the Mediterranean tradition. Internationally, it's surprising how base some of the fancying of this bird becomes as we travel west into the United Kingdom compared to the nightingale's association with devotional music and melodrama further east in Europe and Asia. The Rood Index, compiled by Steve Rood, is a taxonomical system of folk song, covering the entire repertoire of songs and every instance of a song being noted, recorded, collected, printed, and published across the English-speaking world. The index hosts 570 songs with nightingale in the title. Admittedly, many of these are the names of ships, waltzes, and other dances or tunes known simply as the nightingale. But this is still a prolific number. In fact, the nightingale is only beaten by blackbirds, with 611 instances on record, mostly due to the massive popularity of the song If I Was a Blackbird, known by almost every folk singer from whom songs were collected. Every country seems to have a sense of ownership of the bird. That much is universal. Wales has not known a nesting nightingale, Eos, in the Welsh language, for a very long time, if ever. Yet the bird is still accepted in song as if it is a common visitor, a staple of the spring morning. In the Welsh song, Little Mountain Birds, the emotional lyricism feels much more connected to the tone of the European nightingale folk songs than to its British counterparts. In England too, the nightingale is rarely far from lovers and physical acts of love, be it in the valleys below or down by some green bushes. There are several significant songs in the United Kingdom that feature principally the nightingale. But no song better summarises the association of the bird with licentious, promiscuous behaviour and questionable morality than the one known simply as the nightingale. This was one of the most popular English folk songs among all singers and was widely reappraised during the British folk revival from the 1950s onwards, often with the alternative name of the Bold Grenadier, the Soldier and the Lady, or One Morning in May. The Nightingale. One morning in May, I spied a young couple. They were making their way. One was a maiden so bright and so fair, and the other was a soldier and a brave volunteer. Good morning, said he. And where are you going, my pretty lady? I'm going out a walking on the banks of the sea just to see the waters glide and hear the nightingale sing. Now they had not been standing but a minute or two when out of his knapsack a fiddle he drew. And the tune that he played made the valleys all ring. Oh, hark, cried the maiden, hear the nightingale sing. Oh, maiden, fair maiden, 'tis time to give o'er. Oh, no, kind soldier, please play one tune more. I'd rather hear your fiddle and the touch of one string than see the waters glide and hear the nightingale sing. Oh, soldier, kind soldier, will you marry me? Oh, no, pretty maiden, that never shall be. I've a wife down in London and children, twice three. Two wives and the army's too many for me. Well, I'll go back to London and I'll stay there for a year. It's often that I'll think of you, my little dear. and if ever I return, it will be in the spring, just to see the waters glide and hear the nightingale sing, to see the waters glide and hear the nightingale sing. Then with kisses and compliments he took her round the middle, and out of his knapsack he drawed forth a fiddle, and he played for such a fine tune as made the groves and valleys ring. "Hark, hark," says the fair maid, "how the nightingales sing." This classic song of love and deceit boasts 133 different versions on record in the United Kingdom, and even more renderings in the United States, such as the cowboy's lustful attempts in the wild rippling water, as it is sometimes known. The British phrases, "he drew out his fiddle, and with the touch of one string, and the nightingale sings," became particularly popular in North American folk song. Interestingly, these versions sometimes include an extra warning verse for women to take care of menfolk. "Come all you young maidens, take warning from me, never place your affections in a cowboy too free. He'll go away and leave you like mine did me, leave you to rock cradles, sing bio baby, leave you to rock cradles, sing bio baby." I interpret such warnings as additional small print for the singer's intended audience. These songs come from the pre-contraceptive era, in a far more puritanical society than the old world where the song originated. Even if you didn't know what the nightingale song sounded like, as country Americans wouldn't have done in those days, you would at least know that men lead women on to hear the nightingale or want to play their fiddle, and are probably best avoided.
A Year in the Life of a Hedgehog, read by Gerald yet again. For many hedgehogs, November marks the end of a busy and productive year. Is there anything more endearing than a hedgehog? Their small, rotund shape, the way they waddle around with a cute, bumbling shuffle. Right about now, hedgehogs should be going into hibernation, and for many individuals, November marks the end of a busy and productive year. Some may have already found a cosy hideaway where they can spend the winter. They're particularly fond of log piles and dead leaves. During hibernation, hedgehogs drop their body temperature to match their surroundings and slow all their bodily functions right down. This makes normal activity impossible, and they save a great deal of energy this way. Although during mild winters, hedgehogs can remain active well into November and December, so if you're lucky, you may spot one before the year is out. They tend to resurface around April when they start fattening up to compensate for weight loss over the winter. Hedgehogs are very partial to cat food, and a shallow dish of fresh water is usually well received. Some well-meaning people think that bread and milk is a wholesome snack for hedgehogs, but they are actually lactose intolerant, and bread holds little nutritional value to them. Meat-based cat or dog food is always best. Mating season begins in May, and by June, many female hedgehogs will be expecting up to 7 little bundles of hoggy joy. While the young are too small to leave the nest, the mother hog will forage in the evening and return nightly to feed her young. When the hoglets are around 4 weeks old, they join their mother on her evening trips to learn the do's and don'ts of foraging, but still return to the nest to take her milk. With August comes the hoglets' independence, and they set off to build their own lives and have their own adventures. Hedgehogs are solitary animals,
so they are unlikely to see their siblings again. Now her babies have left the nest, a mature female may mate again and repeat the events of the past few months. However, this is a risky move, as food is becoming increasingly scarce and late litters often struggle to build up the necessary fat reserves to survive hibernation come winter. As autumn fades and winter takes hold, our spiky friends find themselves right back where they started, tucked away in a cosy winter hidey hole.
This is Anne Marie again, this time returning to... This is Anne Marie returning to Japan, this time over 1,000 years ago. Sei Shonagon was a gentlewoman of the late 10th century imperial court of Empress Teishi in what is now Kyoto, Japan. The pillow book is her journal of musings, anecdotes, and observations of court life. It was completed in the first years of the 11th century and contained over 326 entries. This translation of some of the winter entries is by Meredith McKinney. In winter, the early morning, if snow is falling, of course, it's unutterably delightful. But it's perfect too if there's a pure white frost, or even just when it's very cold, and they hasten to build up the fires in the braziers and carry in fresh charcoal. Infuriating things. People who sit warming themselves at a brazier, stretching their hands out over it and endlessly turning them this way and that. Now, have you ever come across a young person acting in this unattractive fashion? But it seems that as they get older, people will even start propping their feet up to warm them on the edge of the brazier and rubbing them together as they talk. Towards the middle of the 12th month, there was a great fall of snow. The maids collected a large mound of it on the veranda, so then we ladies decided we should have a real snow mountain built out in the garden. We summoned the servants and set them all to work under Her Majesty's orders. The groundsmen, who had come in to clean, got involved as well, and together they all set about creating an absolutely towering snow mountain. It's delightful on an evening when the snow lies piled high and two or three congenial friends settle down together around a brazier near the veranda to talk of this and that. Just as they're beginning to feel that the night must be growing late, they hear shod footsteps approaching. Startled, they peer out and find that it's a man who sometimes arrives like this, unannounced, at just such times. They've put out a straw cushion for him, and he sits there on the veranda with one foot dangling over the edge while they all talk on together. Neither the man nor the ladies within showing any signs of tiring of the conversation until the temple bell sounds for dawn. The cooling of the night watch is a wonderful thing. Deep on a freezing night, I love to hear the clatter of the night watchman dragging his shoes along as he approaches, and the sound of the bow twanging and his distant voice crying his name and the hour. Third quarter, hour of the ox, or fourth quarter, hour of the rat. Then comes the sound of the peg going into the time board. It's lovely to see on a day when the snow lies thick on the ground, and still it keeps snowing, a group of fresh-faced and youthful men of the fourth or fifth rank coming along through the snowy landscape. Their beautifully coloured formal cloaks bear the mark of the leather from their stone belts and are tucked up at the waist in the style of a night guard. They carry Chinese umbrellas held at a slight angle against the strong wind and slanting snow, and on their feet they wear deep leather shoes or short boots, covered to the leggings in pure white snow. It's a delightful and reassuring thing for a man to come calling on a wild, windy night. And a snowy night visit is most splendid of all. He arrives humming to himself the line, "How could I forget her?" or something of the sort. And of course, the scene is particularly charming if he's a secret lover. But even if there's nothing secret about it, there would be something utterly delightful in the sight of his cloak, say the special green formal cloak of a chamberlain, all chilled and damp with snow. A seasonal directional taboo, or the like, has sent you on a roundabout route, and you've made your way back late on a bitterly cold night, teeth chattering so hard your jaw aches. Finally you arrive and draw up at the brazier, and how absolutely wonderful it is to discover, when you unearth the charcoal from beneath the fine ash, that the fire is still as alive as ever, with no burnt out blackened bits. On the 24th day of the 12th month, the service of the Litany of Buddha Names was held at Her Majesty's Palace. It must have been some time past midnight when everyone emerged from hearing the priest perform the second service. The snow that has been falling for some time has finally lifted, and a fierce wind blows. Long icicles hang from everything. Heaps of glittering snow lie here and there on the ground, and all the roofs are white with it, so that even the mean houses of the poor are hidden from view beneath its blanket. The landscape is brightly lit by a pre-dawn moon, and the whole scene is utterly delightful. The houses seem roofed in sheets of silver, while the icicles hanging everywhere along the eaves, some long, some short, as if specially arranged there for display, put one in mind of waterfalls of crystal. In the midst of this unspeakably marvellous scene, the moon shines deep into the carriage as it travels along. Since it lacks outer blinds and the inner blinds have been raised right up, the moonlight glows. The cold spreads crystal clear. You wish you could ride about in that carriage all night long, and you're very sorry when it draws close to its destination.
Okay. Other people's Christmases. Christmas is an exciting time of year for many of us, but is celebrated differently all over the world, from the Netherlands to Australia to Vietnam. The company InterNations employees have shared their Christmas experiences and traditions from their native countries. And first we go to the Netherlands. On Christmas Eve, families gather for a tasty dinner in a cozy atmosphere. Christmas songs play all evening while everyone enjoys their food and catches up on the latest family happenings. After everyone has finished eating and is done talking about the new family additions, recent marriages and job promotions, everyone can't wait to open up their presents, right? Well, this is something that is a little different in the Netherlands because not every family celebrates Christmas with presents. This is due to the fact that we also celebrate Sinterklaas, who looks a lot like Santa Claus, especially when there are young kids in the family who still believe in the existence of Sinterklaas. The Sinterklaas celebration is held on the 5th of December in the evening, which is called Presents Evening, when translated literally. Every kid will receive a poem written especially for them from the Holy Sinterklaas, telling them how well or badly they have been behaving the past year and why they deserve to have these presents. Because this is a typical Dutch tradition celebrated extensively throughout the whole country, some families celebrate Christmas as more of a cozy get-together for the family rather than the traditional American Santa Christmas with loads of presents. In general, it's the families with little kids who still believe in Sinterklaas that celebrate extensively. As the kids in the families grow older, the Christmas cozy get-together overtakes Sinterklaas as the December tradition. And now to Australia. Like any other hot summer morning on the bush block, only half an hour from the centre of the city, we awoke on Christmas to a chorus of cicadas. Today the cicadas played back up to the three Christmas carol albums my mum owns, their broken covers dusted off every year. Played in constant rotation each Christmas, we all know the songs word for word, even anticipating the places the occasional song will skip. It's a fun thing to share, singing random carols in our haphazardly family choir. Mum was awake already, singing Dashing Through the Snow as she watered the thirsty plants by the back door. Water restrictions stipulated that plants could only be watered before 9 a.m. or after 5 p.m, so she was getting in early. After a lazy morning spent in our pyjamas opening presents around the tree, the requisite Christmas aprons were distributed and we began preparing for our great Christmas lunch. Dad rolled the barbecue out onto the lawn, sporting a Santa hat as he flipped the sausages and rissoles. We lunched outside, toasting one another and the year to come with cups of clinking ice and punch, and cracking open our bonbons to find colourful paper party hats and bad jokes. After emptying our plates piled with blackened sausages and a tantalising mosaic of salads, followed by plum pudding and trifles, we lethargically enjoyed the sun, played bulls on the lawn, dragged the kayaks out on the dam, took a relaxed walk amongst the eucalyptus trees, stomping our feet to scare off snakes, and watched kangaroos scatter. We snacked on leftovers for dinner, and with the Christmas gift of full stomachs and contented hearts, we fell into bed, drifting off to sleep with the lullaby of our pedestal fan. And then we go over to Vietnam. In the past, Vietnam did not really celebrate Christmas except the country's Catholic minority population, and 25th of December was just like any other day of the year. Nowadays, Christmas is still not a public holiday. However, people are excited when the time comes and try to make it more special. In Hanoi, we do not have a Christmas tree in each house, but there are many on the streets and in stores. The malls have the biggest ones of all. Hang Ma, a street in the old quarter, which sells all kinds of ever-changing holiday decorations, is packed with drive-by buyers on motorbikes and young people busy taking selfies or pictures for their Christmas photo albums. From the beginning of December, or even earlier, with warming temperatures in the 20s, the whole of Hanoi has a festive vibe with fairy lights, fake snow and electric Santas playing saxophones. The Vietnamese love Christmas, they really do. The traffic is still crazy, maybe even more so, but there is less honking and screaming from angry people because of slow drivers or blocked streets. People tend to slow down, relax, and enjoy the atmosphere by watching the lights as well as listening Christmas songs. It's Christmas magic. On Christmas Eve, instead of staying home and spending time with family, local Vietnamese seem to be keen on heading out to the downtown area to celebrate Christmas. Families have dinner out at a nice restaurant, while young people like to hang out with their friends and have a drink, or walk around the old quarter and watch some artists that they randomly pass playing street music. Some dating couples go to the cinema to watch movies. It is usually crazily crowded in this area at this time. It's absolutely not recommended for people who cannot stand being skin to skin with others. I used to spend time sightseeing a few days before, then stay home or visit my best friend on Christmas Eve to make each other Christmas cards. I just love Christmas.
Well, that's all for this edition. At the end of this recording, you'll hear a Christmas message from our MP, Simon Jupp. Our thanks go to all our readers, to our producer, Sam Clark, and to our registrar, Wendy Eagles.
Thanks also to Archant Publications, Woodburn News, One Magazine, Penguin Book Pitch Publishing, and Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust. So until you hear from us again in our spring edition, we wish you the season's greetings. Stay warm and stay safe. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hello, I'm Simon Jupp, the Member of Parliament for East Devon, and Sidmouth Talking Newspapers have asked me to wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Christmas It's a time for celebration, but I know it can also be a time that's very difficult for some. So if you're struggling this Christmas and need some extra help, please do reach out to me. I'm always here to help as your MP in any way I can. And I'd like to take this opportunity to say thank you to all of the volunteers at the Sidmouth Talking newspaper who do a brilliant job of putting together these audio files for you on a regular basis. I know how important local news is to you. I'm a former local journalist myself, and it's really, really key that the Sidmouth Talking newspapers continue to provide you with brilliant content to keep you up to date with everything that's happening in our area. A big thank you to them, and a Merry Christmas to all of you.